for today's episode, episode 41, which will end part 3 of the miniseries, I am pleased to bring you an interview that I did with Tim Gray, who is the president and founder of the World War II Foundation. So enjoy. Welcome to the show, Tim.
It's great to be on. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really glad that I was that you know the connection was made between us, because I am so interested in hearing anything that you have to say about, you know, Band of Brothers, World War II, Normandy, all that stuff. I mean, no one else can see this but me. But just looking at everything behind you, you know, I know that when it comes to World War II type of movies and stuff like that, you and I are kindred spirits, I guess you could say, from that perspective.
Yeah, definitely. It's a fascinating time, and Hollywood continues to be interested in it. They continue to make movies, miniseries, shows, you name it. I mean, there's just a fascination that Hollywood still has with that time period. So you see a lot of, directors, whether it be Michael Bay or Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, and what they've done with their 3 series. It's just a fascinating time in the history of the world, and people still are reading about it and watching it. And so there hasn't been a decrease in interest, even though it's 80 years since the war was over. Hollywood and authors still really enjoy tackling the topic.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially given the fact that we've crossed the point where I would say 90 to 95% of the men who fought during World War II are not around anymore to give their advice on how to tell their stories. You know, obviously,
yeah,
we know that there are a lot of books and there have been interviews over the years and stuff like that. But, you know, when Saving Private Ryan was made, and also when Band of Brothers was made, there were still there were more of the men that were still around that were able to give their input into things. You know, and now it's a little more difficult. I mean, we saw it even with Masters of the Air, you know, when that came out 2 years ago. They didn't really have anyone to talk to who had firsthand experience of it to give us talking heads to tell us some of the, or to let us see how it really affected the real men at the time, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, just to put it in perspective, there were 16 million Americans who served in World War II, and today there are about 44,000 left. That's about 0.5% are left of the 16 million. So in another 10 years, the last World War II veteran will have passed away. Like the last World War I veteran, Frank Buckles, he passed away. So he was the last remaining guy. He lived to be 109. So there will always be an outlier out there, a veteran who's going to live to 109, 110. But again, you know, the numbers, at least in the United States, of just having 44,000 alive of the 16 million, and even the babies who fought in the war, who went in when they were 16 or 17, now they're 99 or 100
exactly.
Or above. So, yeah, you lose that perspective, and that's what we're up against right now. The window is closing, and you're trying to get to these men and women and survivors and witnesses and get their firsthand accounts before they're gone, because after that, then they only exist on a hard drive or in a book, their words in a book. So, now's the time to really focus on the fact that they're going to be leaving us soon.
Right. So what exactly does your foundation do? Why don't we start with that?
We do documentary films on World War II. We've done 44 films for PBS on World War II. They're all focused on the personal stories of that generation. They're all narrated by celebrities. We have Jim Nance from CBS Sports narrates a lot of our films. Gary Sinise narrates a lot of our films. Keith Morrison from Dateline narrates our films. We've had everybody from Tom Brokaw and Kevin Bacon to Luke Bryan and Darius Rucker and others narrate our films. Liev Schreiber. So we do documentary films, and then we have a museum in Rhode Island that was just named by National Geographic as one of the top 10 World War II museums in the world that people should visit.
Wow.
We're up there with the National World War II Museum in New Orleans and the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum in Poland and the Museum of the Pacific out in Fredericksburg, Texas. And, you know, it's just an honor. So, you know, we focus on the films, we focus on the museum, and then we have an educational component where we take college students with us every year back to Europe to film a couple of documentaries. So we partner with major universities in the United States and get their top filmmakers and historians to go with us to Europe. And it's just a great experience for the students, a lot of whom have never been out of the country before. It's their first passport.
Wow.
We give them a taste of World War II culture, but also the culture of the places that we visit. So we've taken them to the Eagle's Nest and Berchtesgaden and Dachau and Italy and Germany, Austria. This year was the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany again, and Luxembourg. So it's just a really good way to educate young people about World War II, because they're really not taught about it in schools. And once they're told of these amazing stories by the people who went through these ordeals, they're just absolutely fascinated. So we're just trying to make sure the new generations out there don't forget what the greatest generation did for all of us and how they went about their business at the time.
Wow, that is amazing. I got to first say that you know, now I feel bad I didn't know you three and a half years ago when I was in the States, because I was in Rhode Island. I would have come. I guess next time I plan a trip, I'm going to have to,
We're down in the southern part of the state, and I'd been collecting artifacts as a kid. And then, you know, it just got to the point where this museum now has about 7,000 artifacts, and we've got some really rare items. Yeah, we have the shovel that Hitler used to christen the Autobahn in Germany. We've got Blondie's dog collar. We've got Hermann Goering's pajamas, his nightshirt, which is kind of spooky. But yeah, just a lot of interesting items that we try to get young people to get, you know, kind of acclimated with and get interested in that time period. So
okay, so let's just go, what's your history with Band of Brothers, with you know, any of the men from Easy Company or the actors in the movie or the miniseries or anything regarding the production, you know, things like that?
In 2012, the World War II Foundation raised the money and dedicated the Richard Winters Leadership Monument in Normandy. So this is a monument behind Utah Beach. It's about 13 feet high with the likeness of Dick Winters. And it recognizes not only Dick Winters, but all the junior officers of the American troops who landed on D-Day and had to take command, whether it was because their company commander or, you know, in this case, Thomas Meehan was killed on D-Day, and Dick Winters really was took over at that point as the commander of Easy Company. So we've done that. We built that monument, which has become one of the more popular monuments to visit in all of Normandy, because it recognizes Dick Winters and all the men who were leaders on D-Day. So we spent a lot of time in Normandy. We spent a lot of time in Normandy filming. We spent a lot of time in Normandy having events with the Band of Brothers actors over the years. Great group of guys. They would come to our film festival that we had in Normandy, and we'd have events at the Utah Beach Museum or the Overlord Museum at Omaha Beach or the D-Day Experience. So we got to know a lot of the actors. We got to know a lot of the veterans who were still alive when we started to do all this, like Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron and Brad Freeman and Buck Compton and several others. So we started to incorporate a lot of the veterans who were alive at the time into our films. All of them are gone now. The last original Band of Brother who passed away was Brad Freeman. So all the guys are gone now, and it's now kind of the actors who are carrying on the legacy of the men they represented in the series, and they've done an incredible job of doing that. So we've been connected with the Band of Brothers story since about 2010, when we had our first event in Providence, Rhode Island. James Matteo came in, and Ross McCall. We had Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron there. And we also had Ron Drez. Ron Drez doesn't get enough credit, but Ron is really the guy who discovered the Band of Brothers story for Stephen Ambrose and told Stephen Ambrose about a reunion that Ron had wandered into in New Orleans, where Easy Company was having their annual reunion. And Ron Drez went in there and found this rowdy group of paratroopers who were having a reunion, and told Stephen Ambrose about it. And Ambrose wrote the book Band of Brothers based on those stories. So, you know, it was just one of those situations where they discovered the story of Easy Company, and Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg decided to do a movie that focused on one company's movement throughout Europe and their training, and it's the best series that's ever been done on World War II as far as a mini series like that. I still say The World at War, narrated by Sir Laurence Olivier, is the best documentary series ever done on World War II. That came out in the 70s. But Band of Brothers really raised the bar. And then it was followed by The Pacific and then Masters of the Air. And people just really resonated with the stories of these men, as they should.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I find the most amazing about the whole thing is, you know, having read the book is not really told in a very narrative fashion, but the way that they were able to take the words of Ambrose and create something so powerful and so gripping that you really care about the characters so much. So, I mean, the writers just did an amazing job making that translation from Ambrose's book, which in some ways could be pretty boring the way that he writes it. Let's put it that way. Again, once you're familiar with the characters and stuff like that, it's more interesting to read. But overall, it feels I don't know. In some ways, it feels a little bland the way that he writes it. But you know, once you know who the characters are, it brings things to life. And so you know, having seen the miniseries, I've seen it probably at least 20 times. That would be my guess. You know, over the last 20 or 4 years, you know, and it's just so amazing to watch. I'm familiar. Like, I will talk to people and I'll mention names of characters and they'll be like, who's that? Which one's that? And, I'm a little more familiar, right, which is obviously why I'm doing this season this way, because I'm very familiar with it, but I want more people to be more familiar with everything that's going on there also and stuff like that. So do you have any stories about anecdotes about things that might have happened, you know, when you were with any of the men from Easy or any of the actors and stuff like that during the course of all of these reunions or conferences that you've had with them over the years?
The interesting thing I think of a lot is Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron, because they were both from South Philly. And, you know, people aren't probably old enough to remember all the vaudeville days of the 1920s and the 1930s, but there used to be acts that would go on the road and entertain people, whether it be song and dance or music or comedy. And I always felt as though that Bill and Babe would have been great to go out on the road to do a vaudeville act somewhere together, because they were just two of the funniest guys that you would ever run across. They all had that South Philly persona. But they were just really funny, and they didn't care about political correctness. They didn't care, you know, they were from, you know, South Philly. So they were just, you know, two peas in a pod. And I miss those guys. I remember being in a diner with Babe one day in South Philly, the Oregon Diner in South Philly. And we were teaching Babe how to text. Babe didn't know how to text on his phone. So it was just funny watching Babe Heffron learning to text on an iPhone and just really not understanding quite what this new technology was all about. And we have these great photos of him in the diner, you know, on his phone, like trying to learn how to text. But yeah, I mean, you know, you spend a lot of time with the guys, you spend a lot of time with the actors, and there are a lot of personal stories that, you know, come out. But the one thing about the actors is and this is reinforced over the years that we've known them, is that they really treated these roles differently than they did any other role that they had. Because they got a lot of the times, not all the time, but a lot of the times they got to meet the actual veterans that they were portraying in the series. They would come to the set in England when they were filming, or they'd get together with them somewhere else. So they became friends. The actors became part of the family dynamic of a lot of these veterans. I know it was that way with James Matteo and Frank Perconte, especially. They, you know, Jimmy became one of the family members. And so it wasn't just like they were playing another role. They had to get the role right because they were playing somebody who was still alive or somebody who was caught up in a situation where accuracy was the most important thing. So even if you ask these guys today, a lot of them will tell you that was the most important role they've ever had in their careers, because of the circumstances of playing somebody who did extraordinary things and wanting to get that story right, and then having the opportunity to meet the actual veterans. It's Hollywood. And Tom Hanks always said, you know, when you do a film based on a true story, 11 or 12% of it is actually true. The rest of it is just Hollywood adding on the dialogue and adding on circumstances and other things and whatever it may be. So, you know, Hollywood did a great job, and Hanks and Spielberg and Bruce McKenna and Tony Toe and all those guys, the writers, did a great job of character development in that series. So you got to know Lewis Nixon, you got to know Colonel Sink and Dick Winters, and you got to know Spears, and, you know, the writing of that series was just over the top phenomenal. And I think that's what separates it from other programs that are out there. People got to really know the characters and become emotionally involved and invested in Bill Garnier and Joe Toy when they lost their legs in Bastogne, you know, or, you know, David Webster's character when he comes back after missing the Battle of the Bulge, and the guys treat him like he's a replacement again. Right. So, I mean, it's just all the writing that went into each episode, from Curry and Day of Days to Crossroads, Replacements, Bastogne, the Final Patrol, and Hagenau. The writing was just amazing, and they brought the situations and the characters to life, and the accuracy pretty much of what they were involved in at the time. So, yeah, that's what makes it such a special series. And you mentioned the writing earlier, and that to me is the biggest takeaway from Band of Brothers is the writing and the character development, and you as a viewer getting to know Bull Randleman and getting to know everybody else who was featured throughout the series, Hubler and everyone else. So, I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, I always love the fact how each episode more or less focuses on a different character while still focusing on the others. You know, it doesn't just tell the story. It's not like a Rashomon thing where it's just telling you the perspective of one of the characters. But each of the episodes feels, or each of the parts, I gotta always use the correct terminology, because there's 10 parts, not 10 episodes. So each of the parts is told in a slightly different way because of who's basically being focused on, but you're still getting everything about all the other guys at the same time. Which is just, again, it's so fascinating to watch because of that.
Yeah, I agree. In character development, when you mention that, you look at Doc Rowe's character, Eugene Rowe, the medic, and the two Bastogne episodes, and how they really focused on Shane Taylor's character, Doc Rowe, in those episodes, and how, you know, as a frontline medic, the war affected him. I mean, you know, you talk about the frontline medics and even the corpsmen in the Pacific, they experienced the worst of the war. I mean, they're having to go into the situations where they're being shelled and the trees are bursting, and they're going in having to rescue people. And, you know, I thought with the episodes, the Bastogne episodes, with the development of Shane Taylor's character, you know, Doc Rowe really came through as somebody who he was. And, you know, you can only take so much. Everybody in war has a breaking point. And it's surprising that not more men broke during Bastogne and the shelling and the Bojack and everything else. But again, it just goes back to character development and different episodes with different characters. And you know, with the first episode, obviously they focused a lot on Sobel, David Schwimmer's character, and building up Sobel as a great drill instructor, but an incompetent leader. Sure. And the guys didn't want to go into combat with Sobel as their commander. And that's why they had their little mutiny there. So and Schwimmer was perfect in that role. And all the actors
to play that role, you know, it was so much against cast, and it's perfect.
Yeah, it's a tough role to pull off.
Yeah, he really did. Again, we obviously during you know, my dissection of the first part, we talked a lot about it. I mean, Sobel, on the one hand, as you said, he was a great commander, but not a great leader. And from that perspective, they did such an amazing job, because Easy Company wouldn't have been what it was without the harsh way that he trained them. And he helped form the bonds that they had, because they all, you know, they all bonded together in the fact that they wanted to kill him, you know. But on the other hand, he helped make them one of the best companies that fought, you know, around that time. So.
And the guys have said that the actual veterans have given Sobel the credit for bringing them together and being an effective training officer. But that's really where it ended for Sobel. He was not a guy who was going to be a leader in combat. In fact, he probably would get a lot of men killed in combat. And the guys recognized this. But you're right. They were able to focus more as a team and as a company because of their hatred of Sobel. But the authors we've spoken to over the years, like Marcus Brotherton and others, and the veterans have said he was a good training officer. He was a guy who was, you know, prepared them well, just not a guy you want to lead and, you know, lead you in combat.
Correct. Seriously. And when it comes to, like, most of the time you said that you usually deal with documentaries. So, mm-hmm. you know, what is your perspective on the way that this story is partial documentary and partially not, because of the way they bring in the talking heads to quickly tell us little bits and pieces before it's expanded on, you know, from that perspective?
I think it was great. And I like the fact that they didn't identify the guys until the end. They did a special documentary at the end of the series mm-hmm. with Dick Winters and everybody else. And they finally identified who the guys were. Extremely effective to hear from the veterans and then hear the story. And some of the veteran interviews with Shifty Powers and others were just very strong, and Dick Winters and Don Malarkey and guys like that. So to have those at the beginning of every episode was extremely effective. Because you got to know a little bit what the real guy sounded like, what the real veteran looked like. And then from Dick Winters, then you start to see Damian Lewis playing Dick Winters. And right. So I liked it a lot. And I also thought the documentary at the end was very, very well done, explaining really more of the real story of Easy Company and expanding on the shorter interviews that were done with the veterans. And taking Bill and Babe back to Bastogne and places like that. And I thought it was a great way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, I've always believed that the main reason they didn't identify who they were was to not give us spoilers as to who's going to survive the series or not, you know, from that perspective. But again, I still remember the first time I saw it, you know, wondering, okay, who's that one? Who's this guy? And, you know, once you do find out who they are and then you rewatch it, it changes the perspective also, because now, you know, okay, this is Dick Winters and this is what Dick Winters is saying, you know, as opposed to this is just one of the guys talking, you know, that type of thing. So I
and thinking about when it came out, I mean, the series came out just a few days before 9/11.
Correct.
So that, you know, the first episode airs, there's 9/11, then America became very patriotic after that. So the series itself stands on its own, but the timing of when it came out, I think, helped get it traction and helped bring more people, more eyeballs to it when it eventually picked up again after 9/11. And it just was showcasing the best of what America had to offer in World War II. I mean, really, they could have focused on companies from the 82nd Airborne Division or the 1st Infantry Division or the 29th Infantry Division or, you know, so in a way they narrowed in on Easy Company, but Easy Company came to represent all of the other companies and units and divisions and corps and everybody else who fought in World War II. Some veterans will say, oh, you know, they got so much publicity and we did even more. And it's like, yeah, but you know, everyone always gets mad at the person who wins the lottery. And right. And if Ron Drez doesn't walk into that hotel in New Orleans during their reunion and start to capture their stories, then maybe it's somebody else, or maybe it's Hanks and Spielberg are doing a series on another company from another division. Who knows? It just, it worked out well that Easy Company represented on television the greatness that America brought to World War II, and young men who were trained properly and for the most part were great leaders and followed their leaders and were excellent soldiers. So, you know, there are a lot of companies out there who could have been in that series. That was the focus. And hopefully what that did is get people interested in doing more research into World War II and learning more about the other divisions who fought in Europe and the Pacific and other places, because really they were all a band of brothers. All these men who fought together for so long had the same bond that the men of Easy Company had. It just happened to be in the Pacific and in Guadalcanal or Iwo Jima or in other places in Italy or, you know, other places in France. So Easy Company became representative of what America did in World War II, and they did it in the right way. You know, so that to me opens the door for other people to want to learn more about others who fought.
Yeah, no, one of the things you mentioned is the fact that these men were representative of all the veterans, but, you know, of the stories that I've heard over the years about the men of Easy Company is when they would have these reunions, there were times when guys who were in other units would end up either stumbling into their reunion, or some of the men would bring them there in order that these men would feel the camaraderie. They'd be able to tell their stories and be able to tell it to people who understood what they went through. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming in many of the interviews that you've done over the years, you've dealt with the fact about, you know, veterans who just didn't tell their families anything about what really happened, because that was the way that the Greatest Generation was. You know, they went and did something, and they suppressed it or just didn't feel that there was a need to have to tell that story again and again.
I would say about in 95% of the cases when we've interviewed veterans, their families had no idea that dad or grandpa was awarded a Silver Star on D-Day, or dad or grandpa was at Pearl Harbor, or dad and grandpa, you know, was in the first wave on Iwo Jima. A lot of the veterans tried to shield the things that they did and the things that they saw from their families. But they were more than willing to talk about it amongst themselves because they understood, that their fellow soldiers understood what was seen and what they did. Or they would tell a perfect stranger like myself. So a lot of the times, a lot of these men experienced the worst of the war and didn't want to burden their families because they felt, A, their families probably would look at them differently, or their families wouldn't understand. So to unburden themselves, they talk to each other about it, or they talk to a perfect stranger about it, who's not going to, you know, potentially judge them. More families now want to know what their parents did in World War II. And the biggest regret that we get told to us is that we didn't ask dad what he did in the war when he was in his 70s or early 80s.
Right.
It's too late now because his memory's not as good, or he's gone, he's passed away. So, you know, that they a lot of times will tell their stories as they are getting towards the end of their life, but still reluctant to share the stories with family members. And it's not out of anything other than the fact that they put it behind them. They don't want their family members to look at them as somebody who had to shoot Germans or Japanese in World War II, or witness things like during the liberation of Dachau. And they don't want to go over finding the bodies and the railway cars at Dachau if they were in the 45th Infantry Division or the 42nd Infantry Division who liberated Dachau. So a lot of it is just protecting family members from that and trying to put that in the past and move on with their life. And that's what that generation did. They moved on with their life. They treated World War II like it was a job. They grew up in the Great Depression, so they were already acclimated with not complaining about things and not speaking about certain things because they had seen their parents lose their jobs and the stock market take away all their money, the crash. So, you know, they just treated World War II like it was a job. They came home, they rebuilt America in the late 40s and 50s, and they just went on with their lives. And there was also a survivor's guilt for them because they didn't want to talk about things and people to call them heroes because they felt the real heroes were killed in places like St. Lo and Tarawa and other places like that and are still buried in overseas American cemeteries. So there's just that survivor's guilt that I'm not a hero. The real heroes are buried under the white crosses and stars of David in Normandy and in Manila and Punch Bowl in Hawaii. So it's hard to get things out of them.
But, I've heard that a lot from you know, within Band of Brothers, even, you know, a lot of times, I'm pretty sure it's, is it Garnier or maybe it's Babe that they keep saying that the real heroes were the men who were there, who died, you know, that they don't.
Yeah. Feel Bill and Babe both said that.
Yeah, exactly. They don't feel they did enough.
They say that. They say it often, and they used to say it often. And Babe, I remember Babe saying that a lot, and Bill, and to a man, they will always pretty much say that the real heroes are still in Normandy and never came home.
Right.
Or Mar Groton in Holland.
That's right. Yeah, it's interesting that they would, you know, that they had to carry that guilt for so many years about that also. Yeah. So,
World War II, Rob, was very random. You could be standing there, and the guy next to you takes one in the temple, and you're fine. It just was random killing. And if you don't have some sort of survivor's guilt because of the randomness of that war, then you know you're either really, really, really hard, or you know you've just put it out of your mind because the killing was so random that you could be the middle guy between two guys standing there, and the guy on your left and the guy on your right gets killed, and you're totally unscathed. Right. And who can figure that out? You know, there's no figuring that out. It's just the randomness of death. I mean, you're talking about a war that killed 60 million people. 414,000 Americans, but you know, who lived and who didn't in combat was something that guys didn't want to think about, but they did a lot more thinking about it when they came home.
Right. They had many, many years to think it over. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else that you feel you want to bring up?
I like to watch Band of Brothers with the captions on when I watch it, because you miss a lot of dialogue sometimes when you're just watching it without the captions. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot over the years by putting the captions on and picking up little nuances of what Garnier says, or Malarkey, or Sobel, or Winters, or Nixon. Just little things that you pick up after you've watched the series 100 times. You start thinking of different ways to watch it. And, right. And I do that with the captions on, and I've picked up a lot over the years. So if you've never watched it with the captions on, try it once, and you'll pick up a lot of little things that are said that you don't pick up just watching the series without the captions on. And, We've been back to all these places many times, whether it's Normandy or whether it's Toccoa in Georgia or Bastogne or the crossroads in the Netherlands and Holland and all these places. And when you go back, you picture what happened there because of the television series. It's not so much from archival video, it's from the series, because they did such a great job recreating all of these places, not in the places where it actually happened. I mean, the Bastogne episodes were shot indoors in a studio, and they were able to build snow in a forest and do all that stuff in a studio. I mean, it's just mind-blowing, the creative people that they had working on that series. not only the costume designers and the set designers and the writers and everyone else, but it was the perfect storm of a series taking the world and still people today. I mean, when they see the actors in France at a reunion or something, those actors are representing the men who are gone. So they become the veterans de facto, and they're not the veterans. They would never say they're the veterans, but James Matteo is Frank Perconti, and more people know, you know, James Matteo as Frank Perconti than know what Frank Perconti looks like as Frank Perconti.
Correct.
So it's great to see these actors engage with the audience and the military, current military who interact with them in places like Saint-Mère-Église and other places in France. They come up to them and say, the reason I got in the military is Band of Brothers. I loved the series and I became a paratrooper because of the series. And that's pretty heavy stuff, you know, for an actor to deal with, that somebody joined the military because of the acting job that they did in a series. And it's meaningful to them, very meaningful.
Yeah. No, and one of the things also is the fact that here, you know, this is how many actors who are not in, I guess you could say, you know, the top A-list are recognized for a role that they did 24 years ago. You know, like when I was, you know, discussing, I've had discussions about Band of Brothers and, you know, most of the actors in the entire series are not actors that are very well known, or at least at the time they weren't very well known.
You know, now, at the time.
Now there are a few that had minor roles that are much more recognizable, but overall, you know, you won't say, okay, you know, this is it's not even like Saving Private Ryan. Saving Private Ryan, you know, you have eight main actors, and just about every one of them made it big afterwards. You know, that you can look at them and say, "Wow, okay, I know that who that is. I know that is," and stuff like that. But here, these are actors who, you know, when I will see any of them in something else, I'll be like, "Oh, that's so and so. You know, he played so and so on Band of Brothers," as opposed to saying, "Oh, this is the actor." You know, that type of thing. So to me, it's just amazing to think about the fact that after a quarter of a century, these actors are still recognized for this role. And at the same time, they still identify with that role also.
There were some great actors' performances. David Schwimmer was really the only guy who came in who was really well known because of Friends. Dale Dye had been in movies before. He played Colonel Sink, so he was recognizable. Damian Lewis at the time, you know, was relatively new.
Yes.
You know, you look at the guys today. You know, Ron Livingston was known from Office Space, who played Lewis Nixon and other programs. Yes. But then you look at the guys like Frank John Hughes, Michael Fassbender, Tom Hardy, Damian Lewis, you know, Jimmy Matteo, you see them acting all the time.
Correct.
It was a big role for them. Jimmy had already been in other productions. He was in Hook with you know, an all-star cast, Robin Williams and people like that. Jimmy had been an actor since he was a child. Yeah. He was a little kid, and he, you know, Jimmy's a great actor, but a lot of these guys have gone on to do great things, whether behind the camera as directors or as actors.
I wasn't believing
a lot of careers. Yeah, it launched a lot of careers.
Yes. Yeah, there's no question about that. And it's always great, you know, seeing them anywhere, you know, seeing things that they've done and what they've. But yeah, it's just great. All right. Well, thank you very much for spending time to talk to me about this. Do you want to tell people where they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, if people want to check us out, they can Google World War II Foundation, and we have a lot of our films up there for free. Damian Lewis has narrated one. He did a film on Dick Winters for us. That was amazing. We've done documentaries on the men of Easy Company who weren't really featured in the series and interviewed them. Guys who might have been featured for a little bit, like Ed Tipper and Rod Bain and others who weren't featured really at all. So we were able to sit down with them at a reunion in Las Vegas and really get some amazing interviews with these guys who weren't prominently featured in the series, but were there for all of Tekoa and the Day of Days and all the rest of the episodes. They were there. They just weren't, featured. So yeah, that's where people can find us. We have a global app as well called the World War II Streaming Channel that people can get on their iPhones and Androids and Roku and Fire Stick, and you can watch all of our films there for free. So it's amazing telling these stories. You'll learn a lot about these men and how to live your life the right way.
Wow, that's amazing. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So, Tim, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I will be back tomorrow. Until then, Chris.